Let's take our Bibles and turn to Genesis 24. Genesis 24 happens to be, interestingly enough, the largest chapter in the book of Genesis. Perhaps its relative size underscores the importance that we, the people of God, marry in the Lord. That we, the people of God, seek to establish godly homes in order to advance the gospel promises within the confines of our family and to convey the worship of God onto the next generation. Genesis 24 is a marvelous love story. It is full of dramatic tension, romantic hope, and it has a happy ending. Now, the only thing that we can do at this point is read the chapter together so that we are all familiarized with what it says and the events that it records. And then the time that remains, we'll go back over and unpack the narrative. Now, Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, "Please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. But you will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac." The servant said to him, "Suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came?" Then Abraham said to him, "Beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, 'To your descendants I will give this land,' he will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there." So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. And he made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw water. He said, "O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. So may it be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please let down your jar so that I may drink,' and who answers, 'Drink, and I will water your camels also,' may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master." Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me drink a little water from your jar." She said, "Drink, my lord." And she quickly lowered her jar to her hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing a half shekel and 2 bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels in gold and said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again she said to him, "We have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in." Then the man bowed low and worshipped the Lord. He said, Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. And the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And Laban ran outside to the man at the spring. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrists, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister saying, This is what the man said to me, he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. And he said, Come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels? So the man entered the house. Then Laban unloaded the camels, and he gave straw and feed to the camels, and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. But when food was set before him to eat, he said, I will not eat until I have told my business. And he said, Speak on. So he said, I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master, so that he has become rich. And he has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys. Now Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master in her whole old age, and he has given him all that he has. My master made me swear, saying, You shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live, but you shall go to my father's house and to my relatives and take a wife for my son. I said to my master, Suppose the woman does not follow me. He said to me, The Lord, before whom I have walked, will send his angel with you to make your journey successful, and you will take a wife for my son from my relatives and from my father's house. Then you will be free from my oath when you come to my relatives, and if they do not give her to you, you will be free from my oath. So I came today to the spring and said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now you will make my journey on which I go successful, behold, I am standing by the spring, and may it be that the maiden who comes out to draw and to whom I say, Please let me drink a little water from your jar, and she will say to me, You drink and I will draw for your camels also, let her be the woman whom the Lord has appointed for my master's son. Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder, and went down to the spring and drew, and I said to her, Please let me drink. She quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder and said, Drink, and I will water your camels also. So I drank, and she watered the camels also. Then I asked her and said, Whose daughter are you? And she said, The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, whom Milcah bore to him. And I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrists. And I bowed low and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. So now if you are going to deal kindly and truly with my master, tell me, and if not, let me know, that I may turn to the right hand or to the left. Then Laban and Bethuel replied, The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken. When Abraham's servant heard their words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. The servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. And when he and the men who were with him ate and drank and spent the night, when they arose in the morning, he said, Send me away to my master. But her brother and her mother said, Let the girl stay with us a few days, say 10. Afterward she may go. He said to them, Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away that I may go to my master. And they said, We will call the girl and consult her wishes. Then they called Rebekah and said to her, Will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his men. They blessed Rebekah and said to her, May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. Then Rebekah arose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai Roi, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." Then she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother's, Sarah's, tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now the big question that drives the narrative at this point is, how is the Lord going to accomplish his promises to Abraham? Especially, how will the promised seed be preserved and continued through Isaac into the next generation? As we've learned in Genesis, in the account of the Garden of Eden, in order to be fruitful and multiply, there must be a woman who is fashioned and brought to the man in order to fulfill God's purposes. Well, God fashions and brings such a woman on the scene in Genesis 24. But the main actor in Genesis 24 is none other than the Lord God himself, although he has no speaking role in this part of the story. But he is mentioned 17 times in the chapter, and he is evidently recognized as the one who was directing all things to work together. There's a big lesson that we are to take from Genesis 24 concerns God's providential direction, his sovereignty over the events and course of our lives. Special emphasis is made upon the role of prayer, the precise timing of the events, and the coordinating exercise of man's free will, all of which are things through which God sovereignly works. The main human actor in chapter 24 is the unnamed but pious and wise aged servant of Abraham. He plays a very prominent role, not only in the plot of the story, in this love story, but also as the human bridge that transitions us from the Abrahamic narrative into the Isaac narrative. He is the one who takes the baton, as it were, from Abraham and hands it on to Isaac, so that by we begin the story focusing in with Abraham and we end the story focusing on Isaac. At the beginning of the story, Abraham is seen as the master of this servant. And in verse 65, it is the son of Abraham, Isaac, whom the servant defines as his master. Abraham is phased out of the narrative, and Isaac is positioned in his place as the patriarch, and Rebekah as the new matriarch alongside of him. And especially prominent, of course, is Rebekah. And her actions in this chapter, interestingly, parallel Abraham's actions, and she is profiled in a very positive light. We're also in this chapter introduced to the character Laban, who later shows up in Jacob's life and plays a role in the events of Isaac's son Jacob later in Genesis. Chapter 24 has four main scenes. The first scene transpires in Abraham's tent in Beersheba. The second scene occurs by the side of a well in Mesopotamia. The third scene occurs in Laban's tent in Mesopotamia. And then the fourth scene back again in the Promised Land in the southern area near the Negev. So let's look at scene one, and I'd ask you to just survey verses 1 through 9. Having read the chapter, just allow yourself to familiarize this first scene as I summarize it and point out some things for your consideration. We're introduced to Abraham, who is the aged and the blessed one, and we're told that this is indeed Abraham's situation. He is blessed, just as God had promised he would be. When we wonder how is it that we are to understand him being blessed, well, we can think ahead to what the servant tells Rebekah's family about Abraham. He's been given a son. He's been given riches, but especially he is the possessor of the promises of the Lord. The servant in this story remains unnamed. We might wonder whether or not this is Eliezer, who we heard of back in chapter 15, verse 2 and 3, one who has been with Abraham for a long time. You remember it was speculated that Eliezer may have been obtained in Egypt. And he was a man who had served Abraham for a long time, being in possession over, even being in charge over Abraham's possessions. The thing about Eliezer is not so much the position that he has in the economic structure of Abraham's tribal nation, but the thing is that here is a man who has internalized the faith of Abraham. This is a believer in Abraham's God. And he, Abraham, sends this trusted man. He doesn't send Isaac. Later on, we're going to see that Isaac faces the same problem of finding a wife for Jacob. He sends his son Isaac. Isaac goes back, and Isaac gets ensnared in the devices of Laban and ends up staying away for near 20 years. Abraham doesn't send Isaac. He sends this trusted man back to the family from where he came to find a wife. It could be that the ordeal in Moriah, the sacrifice of Isaac, the recent death of Sarah, made the prospect of being without Isaac something that Abraham simply could not bear. When we read that the servant was to put his hand under the thigh of Abraham to take this oath, that is an Old Testament euphemism for Abraham's genitalia. He is in this likely highlighting the covenant promise of the seed, that this is the organ bearing the sign of the covenant, the sign of circumcision, the instrument from which God will be faithful in providing for Abraham that promised seed. And so the servant swears by the promises of God to Abraham concerning his seed. And in so doing, he is aligning himself with God's promises to Abraham. The name of God in verse 3 recalls the name that God was acknowledged by under the ministry of Melchizedek back in chapter 14 and verse 22. And it is in this name of God that the servant swears to obey Abraham's orders, not to take a wife from among the Canaanites, but to go to Abraham's homeland, to his own family, and there find a wife. Now, dramatic tension builds into the story because there's a possibility that the servant might meet with an unwilling woman. There were such things even back in that day. Should he then take Isaac to her if she's not willing to come to this land? And Abraham issues a stern warning that that shall not happen. This is Abraham's last speaking role in the Bible. And he reveals in these words his faith in the promises of God, the promises that join the promised seed with the promised land. And it's interesting that at the end of his life, Abraham is still defining his entire life experience according to God's initial calling of him from Ur of Chaldea. His promise, to your descendants I will give this land. There must therefore be an intimate connection between the promised seed and the promised land. Isaac, the seed, has to stay on the land and the woman has to come to him. Abraham, who had previously manipulated God's providence, manipulated things in order to accomplish God's promises, you remember, with Pharaoh, with Hagar, with Abimelech, now expresses confidence that the angel of the Lord, to whom Abraham gave hospitality, from whom Abraham was taught the justice concerning the punishment of Sodom, who stayed Abraham's hand on Mount Moriah, Abraham is confident that this angel now is present, and that he's working in the events of his life. And Abraham is not going to be the manipulator anymore. He's confident that the angel of the Lord is present, that he will go with his servants, and he will bring things to pass in keeping with Abraham's faith. Abraham acts upon his faith, but he doesn't presume to dictate to God concerning the terms by which God will fulfill his promises. In verse 8, he acknowledges that if the woman refuses to return, the servant is released from his oath. Except for that part, about not taking Isaac back to Mesopotamia. So with the specifics of the oath laid out, the servant then swears to Abraham as he has been in, as he's been directed, and that swearing of the oath, you notice, forms an inclusio. Verse 2 and 3 and verse 9 are bracketing this scene, emphasizing the oath, so that the servant aligns himself with God's sworn promise to Abraham concerning the obtaining of his seed. The journey that he sets out in is couched in faith in God's promises and reliance upon God's providential presence and God's provisions. That brings us to scene 2. Scene 2 occurs from verse 10 to verse 27. Here, the servant discerns God's faithfulness to Abraham. The trip to Mesopotamia would have taken about a month. And as with the three-day trip from Beersheba to Mount Moriah, so too with this trip, nothing is said, nothing recounted. But the servant does travel with luxury, taking 10 camels. There are other events, and I'll not itemize them for you, in the Old Testament where the number 10 is used in order to specify an abundance of luxury and fullness. He travels to Mesopotamia, which literally means between the rivers of the Tigris and the Euphrates. The city that he goes to is Nahor. It could be a city named Nahor after Nahor, or it could be the city where Nahor lives. The scene that we come to is by a well or by a spring. This is a romantic scene to the eye of the Old Testament reader. This is the place where you would go if you would like to meet a young woman. I saw an article yesterday that Home Depot is becoming such a place for people in our culture. Later in the book of Genesis, you're going to find that Jacob meets Rachel at a well in Genesis 29, and Moses meets Zipporah at a well in Exodus chapter 2. So meeting your loved one at a well is a theme that is beginning to develop here in Genesis. It was a place to meet young women in the early evening because that was the time when the women of the village, the women of the city would come to draw water from the well. You remember that Jesus met the woman at the well in John 4 when? At noon, because she was a social outcast. She wouldn't have been admitted with the other women of the city coming later in the cool of the day. She had to come in the heat of the day to get her water, and that alone. And there she meets Christ. Well, the servant times things, and timing is a very crucial aspect of the story. Timing is crucial in providence. He times things to be at the well at that time of the day and has his camels kneeling, positioned, everything getting set, and he begins to pray. Notice he begins to pray. In verse 45, it's very interesting that he recounts this prayer and he says, I was praying in my heart. He addresses in verse 12, Yahweh, identifying Abraham's God. And he stands before Abraham's God as Abraham's intercessor, interceding in behalf of Abraham. Evidently, he has learned from Abraham's prayers, Abraham who prayed in behalf of Sodom and who prayed in behalf of Lot, and he likewise now, a servant of Abraham's God, intercedes in behalf of Abraham, and he pleads for loving kindness. And that is a word that means covenant faithfulness. He asks for God to give him success on his mission, literally cause for me to occur today. And he emphasizes the timing. The servant is a man who is intent upon accomplishing his mission, but he is thoroughly reliant upon the God of providence. He acts and speaks with an awareness that the angel of the Lord is present with him and the God who has promised Abraham will work in the events of his life. That angel is not referred to explicitly nor mentioned other than by the servant as he refers to his confidence in the direction of the angel as he prays. So he is believing, he is praying, and he is acting upon his faith. His actions are seen in verse 13, where basically he says to the Lord, here I am by the well where the ladies are going to come. I'm doing what I can to succeed in this, make my mission successful. And like Gideon in verse 14, he contrives a test, as Gideon did in Judges chapter 6. and he asks for a sign from the Lord. But notice that the sign is not simply an arbitrary sign. Let the bird fly over to the west or something like that. It's a sign that also sets a certain standard to be met. It's a standard to be met for the character of the woman that he hopes he can find for Isaac. A woman who bears the family likeness of Abraham. The family likeness of being kind to strangers, to give a drink to a stranger, of being hospitable, of even giving water to camels. We gave Jake the Beast his water this morning, and we were all marveling, thinking, when was the last time this dog drank anything? He was just gulping down this big water. Well, you ain't seen nothing if you ain't seen a thirsty camel. Evidently, camels, each camel can drink 25 gallons of water. So in order to water them, this girl would not only have to be kind to strangers, to water the stranger, hospitable, but she's going to have to be willing to roll her sleeves up and do a good piece of work and be very diligent. Would the Lord bring that kind of a woman to the well? And so he prays, and he asks that God, again in verse 14, would demonstrate loving kindness. And so loving kindness, covenant faithfulness to Abraham, becomes the inclusio of this man's prayer. Prayer and providence work together. Here's an example of the Old Testament, in the Old Testament, of the New Testament teaching in Hebrews 4:16. Let us therefore draw near with confidence to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and may find grace to help in time of need. And we can interpret that to mean right at the point, right at the time when the need needs to be met, right at the precise time. And notice the timing. Before he's finished praying, who enters the scene? None other than Rebecca. And Moses presents Rebecca first and foremost, and this is important, he presents her in terms of the genealogy that she has already been introduced to us by in chapter 22, verse 23. Later on, we learn about her beauty. And that's not an inconsequential thing in the Old Testament. We're told about beautiful people in the Old Testament. Sarah was beautiful. Rachel was beautiful. Tamar was beautiful. Rahab was beautiful. Ruth was beautiful. Joseph was handsome. David was handsome. The physical attraction was something that the Scriptures underscore as a commendable trait. But we learn about her beauty later. We learn that she's a virgin later. What is being told to us by that is, this woman meets the qualifications. She's of the genealogy profile, and she's marriageable. Now the question is she going to meet the standards set by the servant? Will the Lord prove that this is the woman? This is a very action, you don't see it right away, but if you were watching this on a stage as a play, this is a very action-packed chapter. There's a lot of running. There's a lot of very quick, active movements. There's a lot of excitement as the human actors work and time their actions coinciding with the guidance and direction of divine providence. Interestingly, when in verse 17 she's asked for a little water, she, Rebecca, immediately gives water to drink, and she initiates the offer of watering the camels. And notice the quickness of everything in verse 20. She quickly runs and tends to all 10 camels. That would have been quite a workout, ladies. You're shrugging, you're taking a big bucket or whatever in your shoulder, and you're running back and forth to this well to put 25 gallons of water per camel, 250 gallons of water you're hoisting while you are feeding these camels. He asks for a little water, and she gives a flood. Where have you seen something like that before? Well, in chapter 18, when Abraham offers to the guests a little water. And then what's he do? You see him running. He's running, and he's preparing, and he's getting his wife and his servant. There's this flurry of activity, and they haul out this huge feast. Well, it's the same kind of thing that we're seeing here. Give me a little water, and she's throwing gallon and gallon and gallon and gallon of water, just like Abraham did. And the servant watches her in silent astonishment to ascertain, could this be the woman? As he's watching her, he's becoming more convinced. This certainly is a diligent woman. When she finishes, he rewards her with jewelry. showing both his goodwill, but she perhaps doesn't realize exactly what's on his mind just yet, that this could be an initial down payment of the bridal price. He asks her to identify herself, and that according to her family line. He wants to get the right family. Is she of Abraham's family? And whether or not then she could give him hospitality in order that he then might pursue her family to obtain her for Isaac. Rebecca, without obtaining permission, which is somewhat unusual, but as we'll see, Rebecca is respected in her family as having a mind of her own. She invites the servant and promises indeed the ample provision for his animals and entourage. Now the servant, I believe, both visibly and audibly prays. And this prayer serves two purposes, both, of course, to thank the Lord and also to inform Rebecca of his identity as Abraham's servant, who's none other than her uncle. He thanks the Lord, who was Abraham's God, for having done what he asked, shown loving kindness, covenant faithfulness. And he acknowledges that he has providentially guided him to the very place and to the very family of Abraham. That's amazing. God, dear brethren, is in the details of your life. He's in the number of hairs on your head. He's in the flight of the bird over your head. Every step you take, every breath you take, is ordered and directed by the Lord. As we read in Psalm 34, 7 and 8, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and rescues him. O taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. The Lord is being faithful to Abraham through answering the prayers of Abraham's intercessor by directing providence. The servant is an example of living in the fear of God. He is consciously aware of the presence and movement of God in the events of his life. Notice he uses the word guiding, that God has guided him. This is a particular vocabulary word used by Moses when he will write of how the Lord led the Israelites through the wilderness to the promised land, that they were guided. This is a vocabulary word that has some weight to it, and it certainly is an encouragement to us as well, for we, the sons of Abraham, are being guided even as we live and sojourn to the promised land. Well, this brings us to the third scene. And now we move to the tent or to the campment of Bethuel, and Rebecca here demonstrates the traits of Abraham. In the way in which I titled these scenes, I'm attempting to show you God is being faithful to Abraham. That God is being faithful to Abraham. And Rebecca here can be seen as demonstrating the traits of Abraham. This scene occurs from chapter 28, or rather verse 28, to verse 61. Now, Laban takes a very prominent role. It's possible that Bethuel is incapacitated. He may be at an age where he simply is not functioning in the family. Some commentators wonder whether or not he might be dead, but there seems to be reference to his involvement in the response in verse 50, Laban and Bethuel reply. Laban, however, assumes the fatherly role in the family, and Rebecca is identified with her mother. So Bethuel is in the background here. And notice the running. If you're watching this on stage, notice that when Laban comes on the scene in verse 28, on verse 29, he is running. Laban ran outside. So if you were seeing this on the stage, broom, he's running in. This is a high activity story. He runs on stage, and that's significant of something of this man's ambitious character. By the time he arrives at the well, he has already taken note of the gifts that Rebecca has received. He has listened to her account of what transpired at the well, and he realizes something really good is about to happen here in terms of his definition of what really good is. He realizes that good fortune has come in the person of this servant from his uncle Abraham. When he greets the servant, He greets him with the words, "Come in, blessed of the Lord." And he uses the word Yahweh. And one has to stop back and wonder just how genuine that expression of piety really is. But like Lot and Abraham, this man of the family of Abraham is a hospitable man. He has prepared the house. He welcomes the servants, prepares and tends to the camels and the entourage, seeks to feed and refresh the men as he sets a meal down before them. But the servant is a man on a mission, and he prudently does not eat the meal until the matters of his assignment are resolved. In so doing, he can control the situation. He avoids unnecessarily, prematurely becoming obligated to his host, because once he takes of the hospitality, now he plays a certain role in the culture of courtesy, and he would be obligated. And so he's maintaining some control just in case the mission fails. He identifies himself as Abraham's servant, and he presents the situation very wisely. Notice how in his account of things, he immediately emphasizes Abraham's wealth. Well, that would be something of interest to Laban, who has taken full a note of the gifts that Rebekah has received. And it's an encouragement to him, because he thinks if Rebekah does go to Abraham, to Isaac, she's entering a very wealthy family. He also tells her that the son that she's going to marry is not some wrinkled up old codger, that this is a son who was born to Sarah when she was old. So you do the math and you get to realize, oh, okay, Isaac is young. That at least is going to be somewhat attractive to Rebekah. Also, he tells her that Isaac is the heir. He is the one who has the inheritance. So all of the wealth is what Rebekah will marry into. So that the situation is attractive. And he explains the reason for his coming, recalling the oath that he has given to Abraham. But notice, he does not mention that Abraham told him, "Do not bring Isaac back here." That might have been a bit insulting. And he does not remind them, "Oh, remember Abraham, he's the guy that left all y'all about 50-some years ago, left the family and left the land." He doesn't mention that. So he navigates his presentation in a way to profile things that complement them. He says that Abraham prohibited Isaac from marrying a Canaanite. And of course the Arameans would say, "Well, of course he would. Who would want to marry a Canaanite?" So he's complimenting them as he's presenting his case. But the dramatic tension is still present, because there's a possibility that the woman might refuse. Note how the servant continually emphasizes the activity of the Lord and his providential engagement. He is assured, and he's not at all embarrassed to tell these people, that the Lord's angel is directing his mission, that he will succeed by the providential provision of the Lord, and he will be free from his oath. If, however, she refuses, he'll still have accomplished his mission. And of course, the audience is on the edge of their seat, because we don't know what Laban is going to say. We don't know how Rebekah will respond. The servant also then recounts meeting with Rebekah. He emphasizes how this has been done by the direction of God in answer to prayer, and how he devised a test which the Lord was pleased to answer, by which the Lord identified in his mind the wife-to-be. The timing is so crucial that even before he finished praying, Rebekah has arrived on the scene. He emphasizes the Lord's intervention and the Lord's involvement. This is a genuinely pious man, and he is not being disingenuous by making these constant references to the Lord. He is a man living in the fear of God, and he wants Laban to know something. Abraham's God is standing to work in Abraham's behalf, and that Abraham's God stands behind all that Abraham has and all that Abraham has promised. So in verse 49, he ends with an appeal. Make your decision. Show kindness or loving kindness. And here's that word again. That loving kindness, that covenant faithfulness and truth. In other words, enter into a covenant-like agreement with me and give Rebekah and promise. And then let me know, is this what your mind is? So Laban and Bethuel, who is somewhere there but not engaged that much, but Laban, they defer to the Lord. They do so, I think, politically. because the servant has made the Lord so prominent and evident in his doings. Remember that this is a moon-worshipping family. We learned earlier about Abraham that he was a moon-worshipper in Chaldea. And you remember the story projecting down when Jacob takes Rachel and leaves. What does Rachel take from Laban that causes Laban to go out and follow her to try to retrieve back what? His idols. All right. So I really question just, you know, how much genuineness is in this man's religious language here. But he does respond deferring to the Lord and says, in effect, look, obviously God is directing, the Lord is directing in this. We're locked up to the Lord. What decision can we make is what he's saying in essence. We have no choice in the matter. Of course, the Lord has spoken. You know, Rebecca is yours. Now, we don't know how they know that much of the Lord. It could be that the Lord, Abraham's God, and news of Abraham's exploits, military victory and acquisition of a great name and so forth, as he had among the Hittites, the sons of Heth, that this reputation has gotten back to his family. And so they're kind of pandering to this man as well. I think, you know, some think that this is a sincere acknowledgement. I still see Laban as a questionable character because of the way in which he acts later on in the story, swindling Jacob. And I think he's a materialistic pagan, but he's putting on the language of religion in order to, because he sees this man and he looks at the camels and he knows that there's some more stuff in them bags. Wonder what that is, you know? Because he knows that the custom is if you get married here, there's a bridal price to be paid. And this guy's just got done telling him of how wealthy he is. So I think, you know, he's, you know, in his mind, he's saying, in his mouth, he's saying, Lord, and in his mind, he's thinking, ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching. But the servant is very pious. And in verse 52, this man is unafraid, and I'm rebuked by this, this man is unafraid to drop down on his knees and begin to pray in front of anybody. At every point of the way, the man just starts to pray. He doesn't care who's there. He doesn't care who's listening. He is walking so close to God that he just drops down and he prays. Now, the words are not recorded. It may be that he prays in his heart, as he did by the well, and it wasn't an audible prayer. But after that prayer, he bestows gifts. You would pay a bridal price in order to compensate the family for the loss of the daughter, the loss of her labor in the home, and the loss of the potential labor from the children that she would bear to the household. With that paid, they feast all through the night. In the morning, the servant wants to leave quickly, return to Abraham, and asks permission to go. But Laban and the mother attempt to delay. And this is where the thing looks to me to be a bit devious on their part. This is exactly what Laban does later when Jacob tries to leave. And Laban causes him to delay and delay and delay. The Hebrew wording in this matter of delaying for perhaps 10 days is very ambiguous. One commentator says you really don't know if he's talking about 10 days, 10 weeks, 10 years. It's, let's just delay in an open way. The idea being, of course, well, come on, we're going to be hospitable to you. But I think behind that is, if we delay this guy, we are going to be able to somehow swindle or get ourselves out of this contract and at the same time be able to manipulate him and obvious wealth that he has with him here. And I think they're trying to contrive something. Remember that the delay for Jacob by Laban's suggestion ended up being 20 years. So, you know, yeah, I'd like to have a cup of tea with you, but you know, I don't want to stay for 20 years. Well, the servant urges, he refuses that, and he urges them to give them the permission. He's not like Lot, who wants to get away from the land and stay out there. He wants to get back, and he wants to settle his business. Laban now consults with Rebekah. And I think at this point, Laban perhaps is hoping that Rebekah is catching on to the family scheme, you see, that Laban and the mother is contriving to keep the servant here and to try to manipulate the situation. And I think he's hoping, now Rebekah, now you fall, you get in line here and you play. We know you've got a role to play in this, but we want you to take the right role. Let's consult with Rebekah. Bruce Waltke comments, this is the most decisive remark in the narrative. Seemingly against her family's wishes, she complies with the Lord's direction, matching Abraham's faith to leave the family back in chapter 12. So like Abraham, Rebekah leaves her family and her own country, and goes to an unknown place, all on the basis of words that have come to her from the Lord, through the servant in this case, in Abraham's case, directly from the Lord. So the family sends her off with the entourage and gives a blessing to her. Now you remember this blessing, may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them, because that's the blessing that God gave to Abraham's seed after the events in Mount Moriah in chapter 22, verse 17, where there was victory promised over their enemies. Here we see the merging of the Lord's blessing on Isaac and his seed, and the family's blessing on Rebekah and her seed. Here both these lineages have this particular blessing originating from the mouth of the Lord, which seems to me to indicate in the narrative that Abraham's seed and Rebekah's seed are merging under the blessing of God. As we saw Abraham depart from Mesopotamia with an entourage some 50 years plus ago, here we see Rebekah depart from Mesopotamia with an entourage headed toward the promised land. So again, you see real parallels between Rebekah and Abraham, both in character, in her decision, and in her action on stage. Scene 4. Isaac and Rebekah assume the role of Abraham and Sarah, and we read of this scene in verse 62 to 67. Now the stage is set and we're back in the promised land. Providence, once again, is directing the course of the events. As the caravan is moving toward the west and arriving in the southern part of Canaan in the evening hours, lo and behold, an individual man, Isaac, is moving north from the Negev, from the area of Beer Lahai Roi. Remember where that is? Of course you don't. Well, you do. Could. It's Genesis 16. That's the well that Hagar named, meaning the Lord sees, the God who sees me. Now, this word that that Isaac is meditating, commentaries are uncertain as to the precise meaning of this Hebrew term. It could mean that he was walking meditatively, or it could mean that he was just simply meandering, that he was just roaming, that he was just moving. It's a hard word, evidently, to get a handle on. The language describes a simultaneous movement of Jacob's eyes and Rebekah's eyes. This is romantic. This is romantic. You know, this is where, you know, she sees him and he sees her, and it is, you know, igniting at the first sight. Right? You know, the violins start playing, you know, the there's a hazy sort of aura around the side of the picture frame. This is where it gets romantic. They both see each other and there's a recognition in one another that this is their, you know, I hate to use the word, but their significant other. Rebekah, having the identity of Isaac made clear to her, she dismounts. And she does that is the significant, because she's not going to be riding a camel when her potential head is in the vicinity. She's going to dismount. That's an act of submission at that juncture. And she puts a shawl or a veil on herself, which also customarily means that she's adorning herself in the garb of a bride-to-be. So she assumes the posture of Isaac's potential bride. Notice the answer to the question that the servant gives is very significant. When Isaac's identity is asked, he says, "He is my master." Now heretofore, the servant's master has always been Abraham. But now the servant here places Isaac in Abraham's place so that we, the reader, recognize that Isaac is now the recognized patriarch of the tribe. Notice he recounts the events of his story to Isaac. There's no account of the servant going back to Abraham and telling Abraham what transpired. To tell Isaac is to fulfill his charge. Now some think that Abraham might be dead at this point, and that when we read of him in chapter 25, we're getting a rewind in the chronology, recapping the end of Abraham's life. But that would mean that this was occurring some 38 years after Sarah's death, and Isaac at this point would be like 75. I'm more comfortable with seeing this event happening earlier in Isaac's life, closer to Sarah's death, He's still mourning Sarah's death, notice, comforting after Sarah's death. He takes Rebekah, he marries her. We're told he loves her. That's a significant thing. It's not always the case in Old Testament marriages that you were privileged to really love the person that you were married to. He loves her. He takes her and he goes into his mother Sarah's tent. E. Fox, quoted in Walkey's commentary, says, "As the story opened with Isaac's father in his last active moments, it closes with the memory of his mother. Isaac is now on his own." That's, you know, for those of us who've experienced the death of a parent, those are significant words. There's a passing into the next generation here. Isaac is now on his own. You know, I remember when my mom died, Randy Pizzino's wife Julie said to me, she says, "You're always a child as long as your parent is alive. But when your parent dies, you realize you've grown up." And this is something of what is signified here. Sarah is now backed away. Abraham has backed off. Isaac now has grown up, if you will. He's on his own. And the story serves to make this point. Isaac is the successor of Abraham. Rebekah is the successor of Sarah. And God is faithful to his covenant promises to Abraham, his friend. Well, in the time that remains, which is none, let me point out to you at least four lessons to learn. Learn the lesson of faith. A lot of believing is going on in this chapter. Abraham's faith, the servant's faith, Rebekah's faith. They all focus on the Lord. They all focus on his words. They all rely upon the Lord's personal presence and involvement in their lives to work his plans and promises to fulfillment. Faith. Providence is the second lesson. It's a big lesson to learn. Our God is living. He's intimately involved in the most seemingly insignificant things of our lives, even when we're meandering on a field. That could be the very time that God is working to bring about his promised blessings to us. We need to be more sensitive. We need to be more aware of that. Prayer. The example of the servant in this is wonderful. Here is an Old Testament character without priest, without sacrifice, without temple, who was praying in his heart. Like Nehemiah, a man of prayer, and a man who through the course of each day is aware that God is with him. What about the whole matter of setting out fleeces? I'm reluctant to advocate contriving tests for God. Yet I believe that the heart of a true child can be expressed like this in real innocence and in real love. And God is often willing to do things to demonstrate his faithfulness, even in things that are less than admirable, perhaps. Your walk with God is your walk with God. This man had a walk with the Lord in which he was confident that he could ask this from God and God answered it. Perhaps there's a challenge for us in that. And then the whole matter of provision. All that is needed for us is given to us in Christ Jesus. And we need to be content and to know that all things necessary for life and godliness are given to us in Christ. That the Father knows you have need of these things. We ought not to be as the Gentiles running about seeking what we shall eat and what we shall put on. The Father knows we have need of these things. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. God will provide for us in the things necessary for us through our pilgrimage. Certainly, in important things like a spouse or the provision for maintaining holy singleness. No good thing does he withhold from those who walk uprightly. Psalm 84:11. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how will he not also with him freely give us all things? Romans 8:32. O taste and see that the Lord is good. How blessed is the man who takes refuge in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for to those who fear him there is no want. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they who seek the Lord shall not be in want of any good thing. God is the God of provision. Let's be a people of prayer, a people of faith, a people of obedience, and the Lord, Jehovah Jireh, will provide. Well, not bad, 67 verses, eh? There are some of you who had some doubts at the beginning of this Sunday school class. Let's pray.